Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great. I'm glad I don't live in Milltown.
I want to share this. those of you who listen to it on podcast have not heard the most recent news, but we've just heard in the news that if you live in Milltown, New Jersey, there's been a water main break. Don't worry, you don't need to boil your water, but you don't want to necessarily wash any
Your light-colored clothes.
Okay, listen, if I can't wash the clothes, I'm boiling the water. Can I suggest dinner out this evening?
Okay.
For those in Milltown, come to New Brunswick.
Water, not cranberry juice, okay? If I can't wash my clothes in it, I don't want to drink it.
I can't see through it. I don't know.
Clear. Water's supposed to be clear almost all the time, huh?
Just an aesthetic thing for me. I don't know. I'm with you on this one, Mark. Reservations for dinner at Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left. 10% off for anyone who can prove they're in Milltown. Okay, that is it. There it is. And all the water you can drink. That's what we're doing out there as a public service. If you're from Milltown and you can show me your driver's license tonight that says you're from Milltown, 10% off dinner tonight and free water. Bottled. I'll give you free bottled water tonight. How's that?
How about Mike Pavlichko? That was phenomenal. He's like, there's no warning to not to boil your water, but they have recommended that you don't wash your light-colored clothes.
I would even offer to do your dry cleaning. The water will probably be back tomorrow. That's hysterical. Okay, let's talk about food since we are the Restaurant Guys.
All right.
Totally serious. You can call the restaurant. Wait till we get back, because unless my staff's listening, they don't know, because I just made this up. If you live in Milltown, it's on your driver's license. You want to come to Catherine Lombardi, your Stage Left tonight. Free water and 10% off here in lovely, clean water, New Brunswick. I love it. 732-8-4444.
I've only been that way for 15 years. No reason you would know.
I was going to give the radio number. Make a reservation and come on in for dinner tonight. We'll give you some water. We can share. Okay, let's talk about wine.
Okay.
There was an article by...
I don't wish to wash my clothes in it.
There was an article by Julia Moskin in the New York Times. She was a guest on the show, was she not?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. She wrote about cooking wine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we always said that when there was cooking... Remember the Holland House cooking wines that your mother would buy in the supermarket?
Sure.
There was Sauternes.
I'm sorry. Your mother bought them. My mother didn't buy them.
Sorry. My mother
was a good cook. She said, oh, this tastes disgusting. Yuck.
The reason you can buy cooking wine in the supermarket is it's a low alcohol content, but it's high enough that you would normally have to sell it in a licensed... you'd have to have a liquor license to sell it, except they salt it.
Well, so they boil it and they salt it.
Whatever.
Yuck.
So, but, I mean, the salting is to keep the alcoholics from going and buying... You know, a $3 bottle of, cooking wine and drinking. And that's why you don't need a liquor license to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot more convenient.
Because it's so disgusting that even if you're an alcoholic, you will not drink it.
But even the rummy won't drink it. Now, can this lead to a great dish? We've always said no. It was Julia Child who came out, actually, and said, if you do not have a good wine to use, it's far better to omit it. For a poor one can spoil a simple dish and utterly debase a noble one. And I believe she said it just like that in her sip of sherry, like you did on her show.
That's your best Julia Child right there.
Oh, you want to go? You want to go? Go ahead. Because I see you criticizing over there, but I don't hear any Julia Child coming out of your mouth.
Oh, I certainly could do a Julia Child.
Well, you know, we should know that I never met Julia Child, but Mark actually did meet Julia Child.
Julia Child once pushed me out of the way at Grand Central Station.
Excuse me!
Right in the middle of the forehead. Wham! See
There's
you later.
A brush with truly, I would say push with greatness is what that was for Mark Pascal. So I never met Julia Child or James Beard, but Mark actually met and they had a conversation. She said, excuse me.
And I said,
So anyway, from Julia Child, speaking from the grave, we came to this new gospel, and the gospel has been, and we've said this many times, never cook with a wine you wouldn't drink. Well, I guess that depends on the standards of what you would drink, really. But what Julia says is that to use a great wine, and this is the other thing. Never use a wine you wouldn't drink. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But as far as using the subtleties of different wine in cooking, you know, like one Riesling versus another, I see some people who cook, and we have some people come to the restaurant and talk about cooking with expensive wine. Really, wine in cooking is not about
the subtle nuance.
You lose the subtle nuance of the wine. It's about adding to the
right.
You're
about to drop a rosemary sprig in there.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
and boil it.
So your subtle nuance is going to go.
But the wine is important, and I think that you can sort of paint with broad strokes when it comes to wine. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you want to use a big Shiraz, I do mess around a little bit with the wines, but the. You know, whether you're going to use a Pinot Noir in a dish or whether you're going to use a big Shiraz from the New World, I find oak sometimes can really express itself in a wine, and I find acid to be very important. But, you know, it's really, I mean, that's only when if I'm not going to cook it for a long time, but I throw a rabbit in a pot and I braise it, mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter that much.
Well, one of the things that does matter, and Julia mentions this in the article, and I think it's a very, very important point when you talk about cooking with wine. Wines that are high in tannins mm-hmm. tend to mess up your food.
And for those of you who don't know, what tannins are, they're wines that are very bitter. Like they have a bitterness to them that's actually not a bad thing. So like in a young Cabernet, we'll have a lot of tannin. That can, depending on the dish, really cause some trouble, as it were. But again, I think that we're painting in really broad strokes here when dealing with wine. I do want to be careful of one thing that I see a lot. We do a lot of restaurant consulting, and often a restaurant will have a bottle of wine that's open behind the bar and forgotten about and sits there for several months, and the wine has really turned.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, oh, well, that wine is bad. Send it to the kitchen. We'll cook with it. That's not really a great idea.
Right.
You know, I mean, and sometimes that works out okay because when you're looking for just structure, but that can really, really do a number on a dish. Why would you
serve an oxidized wine unless you were looking for an oxidized
right.
wine effect?
Why would you ruin yet another dish?
Well, the other thing, you know, Bill Buford in his book Heat about Mario Batali, one of the things he talks about in Mario's Barolo sauce, that Mario uses very little Barolo, I think he says it's California Merlot, which frankly probably goes better with the risotto than the Barolo.
But it probably came from that dish came from an area where the local wine was Nebbiolo and mm-hmm. Barolo, sort of a higher end Barolo, and so it's part of the name, but it really doesn't matter all that much. Hey, listen, we have coming up in just a moment Eric Ripert, who's one of our favorite chefs, cooked us some of the best fish in our life on several occasions. He's the executive chef at Le Bernardin in New York.
We can certainly ask him about cooking with wine.
Yeah, we can do that in just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:14. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We have joining us today Eric Ripert, one of our culinary heroes. He is executive chef and part owner of Le Bernardin in New York City, which has had 4 stars for the New York Times longer than any other restaurant. In 97, GQ named Le Bernardin the best restaurant in America. The Zagat Guide says it's the best food in New York City for the past 4 years. He was also named Best Chef in America by the James Beard Foundation, and I could just go on for the rest of the show talking about all the great things they say about him.
Chef Eric Ripert, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show. You know, we've eaten at Le Bernardin a number of times, and we're amazed by it, and we love it. And it's an oasis of civility in the middle of Manhattan. And your menu there is centered around fish. And it's been said that people who cook fish are a different breed of chef. Do you think the people who cook fish are different?
I don't know if in their normal life they are different, but in the kitchen they have to act slightly different. Fish being so delicate, someone who's in charge of cooking fish or dedicated to seafood has to cook with a different attention, focus, and care, and has to handle the product much differently than cooking meat. Not like cooking one meat, it's better than cooking fish or fish better, but it's a different approach.
And do you think, when you eat out in America, I think that one of the things that people can do, I think it's easier to sort of mess up fish than it is to, I think meat is maybe more forgiving, is that fair?
Yes, it's more forgiving just because of the texture of the meat. It's much stronger in structure and in terms of flavor. Meat, it's very hard to mess up meat. I mean, if you're a professional cook, In fish, a matter of seconds totally change the product. A piece of salmon could be moist 10 seconds ago, and suddenly, if you didn't care about it, becomes dry like a piece of cardboard.
Do you think that's the mistake that people make with fish overall, is that they overcook it or let it go too far?
Yes, I think it's a lot of overcooking at home or even in some restaurants. However, it's difficult to find some fresh fish everywhere. So some people want to play safe and cook it a bit more. But if you don't have good fish, just don't cook it.
Yeah, I'm truly surprised when a restaurant overcooks fish. We see it a lot, and it always surprises me that great fish is pushed too far.
But Chef Repair makes a good point, I think, and I think maybe some of our listeners may not realize that, is if you have a piece of fish that's not quite up to standards, if you overcook it a little bit, it may mask that.
Right, you may be a little better off.
But you can only cook very rare on a perfect piece of fish.
Well, and that actually leads me right into my very next question. For a long time, I felt like I had to go to Fulton Street in order to get the right fish for my restaurant for a long time. Now, you've been sourcing fish for your restaurant at the absolute highest level for a long time. How do you go about sourcing the fish for your restaurant?
Well, we have few very dependable connection, and then we work with them for a long time. We have at the new fish market in Bronx, we have a very, very good connection. Then we have another one in Maine, and we have a Japanese connection in New York as well. And then we have small companies working with us for very specific items. To ensure that you get good quality fish, I mean, obviously you have to have the knowledge and create the relationship with the fishmonger. But it's really a matter of paying the right price and paying on time. Mm. And it sounds very basic, but that makes the difference.
I say very frequently, I talk to people about, you know, the purveyors, and I say, listen, I'm the biggest pain in the neck you're going to have as far as a customer goes. I'm always going to pay you on time because I can't be the biggest jerk and the worst payer. I got to be one or the other.
I remember that there was a guy named Frank Panico who owned a restaurant here in New Brunswick for a long time, and that was his mantra, by the way. He said, always pay the fish purveyor first. And, you know, because you know, on any truck, and I want to ask you more about the fish market in just a moment, but on any truck that's coming out, you can order number one tuna or double A tuna, and there are going to be four or five pieces of number one tuna. One of them's better than the other. Well, if you've got the best relationship with the purveyor, somebody's got to get the best one. I mean, and I think that's why the relationship with the purveyor is so important. Do you see a difference? We used to love to go, although it was very late at night, to the fish market when it was in Manhattan, and we go less often that it's moved out now up to the Bronx. Do you think that it's fundamentally changed since it's moved out there?
I think there's a lot of good things about being moved to the Bronx. First of all, the infrastructure of the Fulton was extremely old, and really, in terms of cleanliness, it was really, really bad. And you had the fish like laying down in the street. And
yeah, it was really
bad.
In the winter,
mm-hmm. It was kind of okay, but in the summer, it was unacceptable. It was no refrigeration.
Well, you could smell it. You walked around Fulton Fish Market in the middle of the summertime. You knew where you were.
Yeah, and then you can throw your clothes in the garbage immediately. I mean, because they never come back.
Yeah.
You cannot wash.
People may think you're kidding, but but Eric is saying a very true thing. We come back from the fish market and stand outside in your backyard and strip and
take
your stuff in a plastic bag to
the hose.
Area.
I mean, seriously, I would stand in my yard with a hose and hose off, you know, my boots and my shoes before I ever went into the house, go into the house, strip down, stand in front of the washing machine, put everything in the washing machine, go up, take a, like, 25-minute shower before I would go in.
And the smell is still on the clothes. Anyway.
What I was about to say is, and those became my fish market clothes.
Exactly.
But we would, but now that it's moved out to the Bronx and there are, it is certainly cleaner and more efficient and they have great refrigeration, do you find it's any less vibrant, though, that fewer restaurateurs are making the trek all the way out to the Bronx to buy the fish themselves?
It's definitely less vibrant. But it's so much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they transport the fish, the way the fish comes out of the market. I mean, we gain a lot of time for deliveries. So the restaurants are delivered in New York, or the purveyors are delivered in New York much earlier than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we lost in folklore, and I missed that of the Fulton. But in terms of really getting the fish in better condition and getting it faster, what they have done in the Bronx, it's fabulous.
Well, we're going to talk about, you know, we talk about fish a lot on this show, and people email us all the time that it's very complicated in selecting different sorts of fish. We're going to talk more about that with maybe one of the best experts in the country on fish and how to cook it, Eric Repaire of La Bernadette Restaurant, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1124.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're speaking with Eric Repaire, executive chef and owner of La Bernadette in New York City, and also author of A Return to Cooking, which we'll talk about in the second half of the show. But we're talking about fish, and Chef Repaire, you're one of the top authorities on cooking fish, and I've had some transformative fish experiences in your dining room. One of the things that I think is very interesting with Americans about fish is trying to get them to try different kinds of fish. I think that in the United States, people tend toward the known and the neutral. But when people use oily fish, and I'm seeing more and more in the hands of a great chef, when people use fish that might be oily, or my grandmother might have called fishy, or a fish like Rouget, which
something,
I'm seeing
in the
market now.
Gamey.
Do you see a resistance to that sort of fish in America, or what's your feeling on the different sorts of fish that America introducing to the American market?
Yeah, well, what I have seen is that I have seen a lot of salmon and tuna. Depending of the region in America, you see a lot of tilapia on menus, or you see halibut in the Northwest. But it's true that you don't see a huge variety of fish being consumed by the customers. But I think it's the same in Europe as well. You know, it's like people recognize few fishes and they like them, and that they're not too adventurous. Fish has been always slightly intimidating in America, I believe, and in Europe as well. People are not very comfortable with fish, except people who live in towns where fishermen are. If not, nobody's really comfortable, and nobody knows exactly how to cook it, and so people play safe a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you push the envelope with the fish that you offer?
Oh, definitely. I mean, here we have about 40 different species.
Well, I actually knew the answer to that question, but but when you push the envelope, how do you push the envelope, how do you find people react? Are people ever dismayed or frightened, and how do you overcome that?
We're lucky to be in New York and to be in a market where our clientele is well traveled, educated, and also people who, when they travel, even if they are businessmen, who are entertained in a lot of good places all over the planet. So we deal with a clientele who's maybe more educated and who takes more risks. However, I think the role of a captain is very important to guide people, to guide the clients through the menu. And also what we do here to make people be more adventurous, we have a couple of testing menus. And in those testing menus, obviously, they know it's lobster, and they know it's wild salmon or tuna, but it's six, seven dishes, and they have to go through other species of fish during the tasting menu.
And when you have a tasting menu, it's small portions. So
if there's something you don't like, you move on to the next thing, and you don't have to worry about it.
It's not a huge commitment.
If you don't like it, we can always replace it.
We're going to break for the news. We're going to come back and talk with one of the best fish chefs in the world, Eric Ruppert of Le Bernardin Restaurant, right after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Eric Ruppert. He is executive chef and owner of Le Bernardin in New York City, one of the top fish restaurants, well, in the world. He's also author of Return to Cooking. Now, Eric, we were talking before the break about, you know, being a fish chef, as it were, not cooking only fish, but having a restaurant that's focused on fish.
Fish-centric, as it were.
Fish-centric. One of the things about fish is I think one of the reasons people are so leery of fish is because, first of all, it is easy to mess it up. And we've all had some bad fish experiences in our life, and there's no bad experience like a bad fish experience. And so we're a little leery. And also, one of the great things about fish is that it can range from, I don't know, Chilean sea bass to rouget to bluefish and to sea urchin, and the textures can be so different. And, you know, we lump it together as a category, but I think that there's more various texture in fish than there is almost in meat. And so the role of the captain is important in guiding someone through that. Can you talk to us about service at Le Bernardin? Because it's not just food that you're known for. It's this amazing service and guiding people through this, I don't know, maybe somewhat intimidating realm of dining.
Yes, sometimes part of the clientele doesn't know all the species that we have on our menu, for example, and some people are a little bit shy. It's the role of the captain to make and the team around him to make the clients feel very comfortable. They're not entering a church; they're entering a restaurant, and it's about having a good time and it's about having a good experience. It's about eating seafood, obviously, since we are specialized in seafood. So the captain has a role to play, which is to identify with who is dealing. Some people, like I said, are very comfortable, and some are less. So without intimidating anyone, we guide them through the menu. We try to see if they are willing, for example, or if they like something like sea urchin, which is a very special taste, or if they wouldn't be able to eat sea urchin, or if they're very afraid. And sometimes what we even do is that we make people taste, they can choose whatever they want, and we make them taste a little piece of, of a sea urchin or ravioli with caviar that we have right now on the menu, or something else.
I think that one of the things, we call that taking the temperature of the table.
Exactly, it's taking the temperature.
And you find out, you know, and we'll say stuff like, well, are you adventurous? Do you want to try something new? I mean, we have one person who comes in and they have the chicken every time they come into the restaurant. But you know what? They love it. So, great, have the chicken. And I'm not going to recommend to that person that they have, you know, oysters and caviar. But someone else, we might. And that's and doing that without feeling intimidated is you know, a very important thing. Let me ask you, though, because I think people who are adventurous are really thrilling to cook for. But there's a whole movement out there that some people call molecular gastronomy and some people call avant-garde cuisine with Grant Achatz, and, of course, inspired by Ferran Adrià of El Bulli. Grant Achatz is going to be on the show next week, by the way. Where you cook... You don't really cook in that school of cuisine.
And neither of our restaurants are in that school at all either.
How do you feel about you know, people who are fundamentally looking to not cook in any sort of with a classic base, but to fundamentally sort of change the texture and...
Talk to us about the molecular gastronomy movement.
Yeah.
Well, I went to El Bulli a couple of years ago, and I didn't think I would like it. However, I had a very, very nice meal. It was about 30 different bites, very small portions. And it was very interesting, the way it's playing with textures and it's surprising you all the time. It's an experience that I like. First of all, it's very unique, and it's the one who created that kind of cooking, which is inspired by technology used in industrial cooking.
Mm-hmm.
My generation, we promoted ingredients, we promoted farmers, we promoted people living, with animals in farms, and the new cooking, you don't even need the good ingredients to do
mm-hmm.
this kind of experience. We were fighting, when I was in school, against those technologies and those chemicals that you're using to create different textures and different... We were fighting that. So it's a little bit of a clash of generation. However, what it does is very interesting. I have found very few people who can use those techniques and do something which is with talent.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very new, and we find a lot of young kids using those techniques and doing basically everything and anything.
It's just a light show as opposed to... There are too many people just creating a light show and not enough talented people kind of creating a special experience.
It's a guy in Chicago at a restaurant called Alinea who does an amazing job.
Right.
Yeah, that's Grant Atkins.
Liking mm-hmm. that new style or not liking it won't make a difference. When Nouvelle Cuisine came in the 70s, the old generation hated it, and Nouvelle Cuisine has a huge impact. So I believe that kind of cooking will have an impact. And what we do here at Le Bernardin, very slowly we integrate some of those techniques into our style.
I think that's the same as when Nouvelle Cuisine came in to, or what then became called New American Cuisine came in to play here. I mean, people really experimented with it, and it was all the rage, and I think that it certainly had a great influence on the food that we're cooking today. But it didn't last in its incarnation as it was in, say, 1985.
Well, it transformed, and I think it went away from...
Do you think that's correct, Eric?
I think it's matures.
Matures,
it's
exactly
also a lot of excess, because basically the guys who create something new are pioneers, and they go a little bit in excess, and when... so it becomes a caricature. But I say fundamentally the changes are made, and then the cuisine evolves, and what they have created many years ago has matured, and today is more into the culture and accepted. But I think they have created many revolutions at the time.
Mm-hmm. Ruth Reichel and Bill Grimes have both said at different times that they're a 3-star restaurant meets expectations and does so perfectly, and a 4-star restaurant should surprise and amaze you. And obviously, the Bernardin has been surprising and amazing people for a very long time as the longest running 4-star restaurant in Manhattan. But I think when we talk about the molecular gastronomy movement, I think that maybe they're taking that surprise and amaze you. They're trying to do it they're trying to surprise and amaze you in a new way. And if you're not really skilled at it and you don't have the basic fundamentals of cooking down, it easily can go astray.
Yes, it's true. And, ultimately, at the end of the day, I always say, if on Sunday I'm going to have choice in between having a carrot foam with a crunchy sweetbread skin and spaghetti of gelatin and...
Don't forget the balloon of rosemary smoke.
and if I have choice in between that and a great chicken roasted with black truffles,
mm-hmm.
I'm going for the chicken.
Hey, we're going over your house on Sunday. We'll see you. Eric, we'll see you around noon. We'll bring some wine. What should we bring? All right, we'll be back in just a moment talking with Eric Repair of Le Bernardin Restaurant, one of the top fish cooks in the world. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1144. The Gillespie Group is the Restaurant Guy's number one choice for flooring. Nobody knows the importance of floors and carpeting better than restaurant people. If your floors don't look good, you don't look good, and that's just the truth. Whether for your home or office or your award-winning restaurant dining rooms, you need the right carpeting. You need great-looking carpets that keep on looking great year after year. To get that every time, you need professionals like the Gillespie Group. Gillespie's cleaning division is effective and competitive, and there's no tougher test of a carpet than a busy restaurant. In our business, details matter. In your home, details matter. matter? Do Bob Gillespie details matter? Okay, so we're so convinced we've got an incentive for you to try Gillespie. Hire Gillespie to clean your carpets just once and get a $50 gift certificate for dinner at Stage Lester Catherine Lombardi. Consult them on any new installation, and if you like what you see, get $100 towards dinner at either one of our fine restaurants if you buy the carpet. Once you go Gillespie, you'll never go anywhere else. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. That's 732-254-5508. Tell them the restaurant guys sent you. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Eric Repair. He's executive chef and owner of Le Bernardin, one of the best fish restaurants in the world. And actually, during the break, Mark reminded me of a very amusing story that we'd like to share with you, Eric. Mark?
Chef, I need to come clean. I need to apologize to you. You had a reservation at 2 o'clock today for 4 of my waiters that I was sending in there. But we got really busy, so I made them cancel. I promised to send them again.
Okay.
We last two nights ago, we looked at the book, and we said, they can't have off on time. They got to work. So they're mad at us.
So my apologies to you and to them, as a matter of fact.
No problem. We'll see you later.
Absolutely.
Now, we're very concerned with fish. One of the things we're concerned about with our restaurant, and one of the things we're very concerned about with this radio show, we talk to great chefs like you, we talk to cocktail people and wine people and people involved, farmers. One of the things we're concerned about is sustainability, and we're in sort of your school of ingredients, keeping family farmers on the farm, you know, whole, real ingredients. One of the things that's most difficult to explain is sourcing fish responsibly. And frankly, and for those of you who are out there listening who want to learn more about it, you can go to seafoodwatch.org or get a seafood guide that you can stick in your wallet. We'll send one to you. If you go to restaurantguysradio.com, you can find out about it. But for restaurateurs and consumers to keep track of what's sustainable and what's in danger and what shouldn't be farmed and what's good for the environment is very complex. I mean, these things affect the way that you order fish as well. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Talk to us about sustainability of the oceans, being such an important fish guy.
Yeah, we are very careful not to use fishes which are on the verge of disappearing. For example, we do not serve Chilean sea bass.
Mm-hmm.
We do not serve swordfish since the last campaign. However, the swordfish came back strongly, but we still do not serve it. We do not serve black grouper. We do not serve farm-raised salmon. Do not serve wild caviar any longer.
Now, go on and on. I want to ask you, there are two sides to that. One is, how do you find out? We use seafoodwatch.org, but how do you find out what's sustainable and what's not?
We are connected with many organizations, one of them being called NRDC, another one Oceana, another one is the Audubon Society, you have, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, the Jean-Michel Cousteau organization. So all those organizations work with us. And we sometimes agree with them, and actually most of the time, and sometimes we tend to disagree with them, and we go on with what we believe is right. But in general, those organizations are well-intentioned and well-informed, and they create, like you said, those mini cards where they recommend certain type of fish, and then put a red flag on some of the species.
I just want to point out that, you know, when Eric says that they do all this work, it is a lot of work, and that is an investment of resources and time of your top people
yes.
to think about this issue and buy sustainably and responsibly.
But you know, I was in a restaurant not that long ago in Tampa, Florida, and, there, you know, I see Chilean sea bass on the menu, and I speak to the owner just briefly, you know, I see you have Chilean sea bass on the menu, you know, there are some problems with Chilean sea bass right now. How come you've chosen to put Chilean sea bass on the menu? And his response is, yeah, 5 years from now, that's going to be all gone. I figure we better get it now.
Yeah, <that's...
laughs> how do I respond to that guy?
You punch him.
it's not the right answer.
Well,
that's for sure.
Now that leads me to the next side of the question. People may go in expecting to find, you know, the usual suspects, salmon and tuna, and every restaurant. If you don't have it one day, how do you talk to your customers who say, well, I want Chilean sea bass. I love swordfish. How does the dialogue go with your customers?
I don't think you're going to lose a client if you do not serve Chilean sea bass, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If in your restaurant you're serving good food and you have a menu which is offering a lot of choice, you will always get that client back. I don't know anyone who refused to go to a restaurant because he doesn't have a specific item. Of course, if you don't have anything, people mm-hmm. will go somewhere else. But,
right.
but there's many options. And if, for example, in a tuna, you don't serve bluefin tuna, but you can serve yellowfin tuna.
Mm-hmm.
The salmon, we don't serve here farm-raised because of the pollution issues and the antibiotics issue. But you can have wild salmon. Chilean sea bass, you can find a fish which is slightly in the same category, kind of rich and slightly oily and moist, and you know you can find some parallel species.
You know, we talked earlier about you know, having to have a deft hand when you're cooking fish. I think one of the great appeals to Chilean sea bass is it kind of holds its texture and its moisture even when you overcook it. So
yes,
frequently a lot of people who maybe aren't as talented as you are falling back on a fish like Chilean sea bass because it's easier to use.
It is easy to use, and it tastes good, actually. and the name is kind of appealing. You know,
sure.
the real name of that fish is Patagonian toothfish.
Less appealing. And if you ever saw a picture of it, you would stop eating it for
really
sure.
Really ugly, yes.
Ugly fish.
Actually, I've started a new campaign for like people who want to order swordfish. The easiest way to get them not to eat swordfish is to talk about all the parasitic worms that come in the swordfish every time.
Yes, well,
every time
the water is warm.
Yeah.
Swordfish has, a lot of them have the tendency to get parasites. Yes.
Okay, you guys are grossing me out. So
well, it's an easy way to. It's an easy.
I don't
to
eat swordfish. Okay, so let's talk about the other thing is, you know, when you have a fish restaurant, it's a high wire act in a lot of ways. You have to be careful, more careful about how you source. You've got to be more deft in the cooking. It's easier to ruin, and your captains have to be more to be able to communicate more with your clients.
Yes.
About the great variety, but you also wine is a very important part of Le Bernardin, and with pairing fish and wine is a much more delicate than say pairing fish with meat. It's also less forgiving. The wrong bottle of wine can really overwhelm different sorts of fish, and the wrong fish can overwhelm certain bottles of wine. How important is wine to what you do there, and what's your philosophy behind it at Le Bernardin?
Well, we have a team here of four sommeliers. And what we do, we them and the captains, actually, and the front waiters, everybody tests the food. And then with the sommelier, we work together as a team, and we try to pair, obviously, the right wine with the right recipe. Most of the time in a wine pairing, what is important is not only the fish, but is the preparation going with it, the sauce going with it. And, for example, what we do here, it's in the winter or in a cold season, we use a lot of ingredients which are going to be friendly or to enhance the qualities of red wine. When we go to the hot season, we have the tendency of using ingredients that are promoting more white wines. But all year long, we still, on our testing menu, we have a wine pairing, and we like to have different wines on that pairing coming from all over the planet, but we always end up with a red wine toward the end. So I always design recipes for those tasting menus, and always we have few recipes on our menu which are friendly to red wine as well.
Well, if you want to try some of the best fish anywhere, as Mark and I are going to do with our staff, we may have to kick in for some lunch.
Maybe that reservation's gone from 4 to 6. Is that what you just said?
But if you want to try Le Bernardin, you can find out how to get there through restaurantguysradio.com. You can also find out about Eric Repair's excellent book, A Return to Cooking, which is a lovely cookbook he did with Michael Rollman, who is also a guest on the show. Many of you have heard that show as well. And we'll link you all up to that through restaurantguysradio.com. Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Chef, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, we're gonna go have a quick piece of fish, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant.
So, Francis, you know that Eric Repair may have not realized the great move he made with his career. You know, he's been one of the most talented chefs in New York City since 95. Le Bernardin has had 4 stars longer than any other restaurant in New York City. But Eric Repair made one of those moves in his career that will cement him in the Culinary Hall of Fame for all time.
I feel a joke coming. What's that?
He was a guest chef on Top Chef, guest judge on Top Chef.
You know what? I bet that made more people know who he was outside the Top Culinary.
It's sad but true. But, you know, it's one of those things that kind of all of a sudden everybody's like, oh, that's Eric Repair. I mean,
Yeah, he's a good-looking guy, too. People spot him.
He is definitely he's got it all.
Yeah. It was something I'm knocking myself in the head because I forgot to ask him about. I read that he had gone up to Frank Bruni, who is the restaurant critic for the New York Times, mm-hmm. while he was in the dining room and said hello. And I heard that Bruni didn't like that. And Eric was like, well, you know, what am I going to do?
Right.
And I made the same faux pas
to
a very important restaurant critic several years ago. And I'll tell you, she had written great reviews about us until that time.
And then stopped.
Never said a kind word about. And when I went over and said hello, the look of horror on her face.
Face dropped.
But, you know, I know who she is. I had met her. But
you know, I that whole game, I don't understand. We talked about it with Ruth Rachel once before.
And she said, don't be stupid.
Don't go up and say hello is exactly what she said. So
I know that
now. We're not stupid anymore. But I don't understand how, I mean, you meet these people, okay? You meet them over time. They were in your restaurant. You spoke to them. Then they wrote a review about your conversation. You remember who they were. If you're a good maitre d', or a great chef like Eric Repair, and you meet the New York Times restaurant critic, you're not going to forget that person. You're never going to forget that person. It's etched in your memory, those moments.
Well, and when you see someone you know in your dining room, actually, you say hello to anyone in your dining room, but if you know someone, you make a recognition. But evidently, you know what? Eric Repair did that. Frank Bruni didn't like it. I did that. The critic here in New Jersey, who shall remain nameless, didn't like it. Because as much as she didn't like it then, she'd like it less, I think, if she heard me talking about it on the radio.
I think you're probably right. I think you're probably correct.
So here's a word of advice to restaurateurs. You spot a critic in your dining room? Just lay back, be cool, everything will be fine. Don't go say hello. Say hello on the street. All right, well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. What a wonderful conversation with one of the best fish cooks, fish chefs in the world. And again, I recommend you go into his restaurant. There's nothing like it in New York. Classical and beautiful.
And if you want to hear the counterpoint, next week we're going to have Grant Ackitts from Alinea from Chicago, who's doing the molecular gastronomy thing.
Just can't wait. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 12 noon.